You're listening to Not My First Guess. I'm Hattie Willis, your host, and each episode I talk to an entrepreneur, investor, or startup expert to unpack their hardest moments, biggest wins, and hard-earned advice so we can shortcut our learnings as founders together. This episode, we meet Emily Cummins, founder of Untangle, a community-driven grief support platform. This is a startup whose mission really resonates with me personally, as I went through a loss myself a few years ago. And I think many of us can empathize with those who've been through that deep loss, whether in a bereavement, as in my case, or something like a divorce. I think that's why Untangle have been able to build such a strong community already. Now, they are still pre-revenue, but are just about to turn on a series of revenue streams and have already built a more than 40,000 strong Instagram community and an active user base of 12,500 people, showing strong retention, engagement, and referrals. In this episode, Emily shares candidly her journey as a founder so far, including lessons around the surprising gratitude that can come from doing research with customers who need that space to vent, using WhatsApp for their first prototype to prove the need and how people wanted to engage, the power of continuing to facilitate meetups with community members to this day as a founder, some of the harder moments too, particularly around things like fundraising and development, including her advice on when to trust your gut and build sooner. Without further ado, let's start the show. Emily, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here and talk to you.
There's a lot I want to dig in, so let's start at the beginning. You are obviously now the founder of Untangle, but was being a founder something you thought you'd do? Was that a career path you wanted? How did you end up as an entrepreneur?
It's a good question. I think I always did want to set up my own business. I remember being about 8 and saying I wanted to be an author illustrator that ran my own company and traveled the world, which is funny because the author illustrator thing is not anywhere on my like life plan at the moment. But it has always been something I've been interested in. Both my parents ran their own businesses, and I think I grew up in that kind of environment that this is exciting and you can do something yourself. And it was really the reason I set up Untangle wasn't because I wanted to start a business. It was because I saw an opportunity and a need and went through a difficult experience myself and wanted to change it for other people. So yes, I say that's something I've always wanted to do, but actually it wasn't. I don't think you can just say I want to start a business. You have to be passionate about something and care about something or see a big opportunity and say, yeah, that's something I want to take and do.
Maybe let's talk really briefly about your kind of career before Untangle. So am I right in the sense that you were already working with Zinc, which is an accelerator, venture builder, before the idea, or how did that order come about? And maybe if you can tell us a little bit about Zinc as well.
Sure. So I think I've had an interesting career. I've always done strategy and business strategy. So I worked with an early stage insurance startup as kind of employee number one. And then I went to Kingfisher, who own like the biggest DIY retailer in Europe. They own B&Q, Screwfix, and I led their tradespeople strategy for the group. So it was like doing innovation, but in a big corporate. And then around that time, basically, my parents got divorced and my grandpa died, and I was very close to him and supporting my mum through just a really difficult time. And you just don't know what to do. And you go on Google and there's like hundreds of answers and responses. And then you try and find the right information and you have questions. You don't know where to go for advice. And then we were doing things like you're trying to work out what to do with the house and like how to go through the paperwork and how to plan the funeral and like who you trust. And it was just so complicated and it was really difficult. And so around that time, I was like, why is there not just a place you can go to get help and advice and support and all the services you need at these times in your life? Like you can do that when you're training for a marathon or moving house or having a baby, but there's not somewhere for these big things. So I had this idea and I was sitting on it. And then what happened was I discovered Zinc. They're a tech for good business incubator and accelerator. And I thought it was really interesting because I've always been interested about how you can change society for the better, but using the private sector. And so Zinc hit that sweet spot for me. I was actually working in the same building at Kingfisher, and Paul, the founder of Zinc, always tells me the story of him remembering me. I went down the stairwell because I wasn't really meant in my lunch break. They did meet and greet, and I arrived in like a pink big jumpsuit, and met with Paul when I was in my lunch break, and just to find out more about what they do. And I was really interested in it and thought, actually, this is really exciting. And it's an opportunity to explore this idea that I've got. And actually, at the time, it was like an open co-working space. They've moved offices since, and they had these studios. So I also was learning belly dancing in one of the studios at the time. And Paul always used to laugh at me and say, I remember you coming down this pink jumpsuit saying, I do belly dancing here. And that was kind of my introduction. But actually, it was a good kind of safety net to take the leap. And at the time, I was looking to move jobs anyway. And he was like, look, we've got a role to support some of the businesses. So I basically went and worked for Zinc for a few months. And I worked with some of their portfolio companies on Mission 2, as it was called, supporting them with kind of strategy. And I'm also quite a hands-on person. I was going to do user interviews and trade shows. And then I worked with one of the businesses for a few months, a health tech business, and then joined the next program to set up my own. So that was, I knew what Zinc was like, and I had the contact, and it was a good kind of springboard to then set something up myself.
Love that. And I want to come back to Zinc, but I really want to dive into the idea a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there's this need, and it's one I really recognize as well. So my mum passed away a few years ago, and I remember my parents aren't together. My dad was one of the executors, and he did so much legwork. So, you know, me and my brother didn't have to do anything. But I remember he told me recently, because he's a very detailed person, and he told me recently he kept a list of all the actions he'd done to try and sort everything out. And he said, oh, I could go and find it, but I think there's 150 actions, like individual actions I had to take to do everything. It's just this hugely intensive space in a time where the last thing you need is to be doing a huge amount of extra work. And I think one of the reasons I got really excited to talk to you is I think the death tech space, as it's sometimes called, is such an impactful one that I would love to see more founders working, because I think there's so much that can be done. And if you think about, we often talk about value propositions as solving this deep pain. What pain is greater than someone having died? You're trying to come to terms with it. So I think what you do is incredible. So how did you get started? You had the idea, you had this deep personal experience. Did the idea come to you as it is today? How did that evolve?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'm sorry you went through that experience. And it is, as we talk about it, it's one of those things that so many people I chat to have gone through it and understand the problem. So really at the beginning, I started, because obviously I'd had the personal experience, but I was like, is this something that other people share too? Have other people struggled to get information and help and work out which services to trust and where to go to chat to other people who get it? So I went online and looked around, and you look at the market, you look at who's out there and what they're offering. And then we went and looked on Facebook groups, for example. There's lots of free Facebook groups, but they're completely unregulated spaces, and they're a bit like the Wild West, to be honest. And we went and I started looking around and basically realized that A, lots of other people experienced this. It wasn't just that I was overwhelmed and couldn't find support. There really isn't much out there. There were a couple of businesses starting up. So Farewell had kind of been going a few years. And I remember chatting to Dan, the founder there, and they were really in the wills and probates. Oh, I think just wills at that point. But there was no one, like, because really, yes, we're death tech, but I would say we're grief tech, which isn't really a thing. But because we support people through grief. So it's whether someone's died, they've had a divorce. We have a 2,000 person kind of divorce community as well, or other big life events that are very complicated. And there really wasn't anyone that was helping people navigate that journey. So I was like, all right, from a market perspective, there's an opportunity. You look at the market size as well. So is there money in this? It's a business. And ultimately, that's what we need to check. And that was why we started with death, actually, because actually it's the biggest market. And yes, there's a hell of a lot of money in it. It's a £102 billion industry. And people spend a lot on planning funerals, going through estate administration, £1 trillion of assets move from generation to generation every year in the UK. So there is just so much in it. So on those lines, I was like, yeah, okay, there's no one else doing it really. There's a lot of money in it. And then the question is, what do we offer? What does that actually look like? So initially, I basically got on the phone and chatted to family, friends. I posted on Facebook groups for bereavement groups saying, look, can anyone have a spare half an hour and just talk to me about their life events, and interviewed people and just asked them to tell their story. And actually, the question I asked people was, what are the three most challenging things that have happened to you in your life, and excluding having children, because I knew I didn't want to do anything with children. And most of these answers were a death, a divorce, an illness, moving overseas, being made redundant, all of these really difficult things, and just understood what is it that people were struggling with, and created this enormous map on the wall in the Zinc office of the customer journey. What were people struggling with? What were they currently using to solve those problems? How much were they spending? And really understanding all those needs. So that was the beginning. And actually, the things we've identified then, those haven't changed. The pains, the needs, the priorities, the things that have shifted as we've developed is, how do we actually help people with those things? It's the how, it's not the why or the what. And so actually the kind of vision was always to help people with their emotional needs, their practical, their legal, their financial, all in one place. Because when you're experiencing it, you're not thinking, oh, right, now I'm having a legal question. Because normally you're probably chatting to your brother-in-law about how to deal with this, and you're having a family argument. It's all tied up together, and you're talking about money. And so the plan was to always create a solution that helped you navigate all of the journey. And that has been consistent from day one. So yeah, it's developed, but that's how we got started. It was Facebook groups, chatting to people, and just mapping it all out.
And it's so interesting you say that, because on multiple points, one, I just keep hitting this drum of please go and speak to customers more at the beginning. So the fact that you did that is just so powerful. And I think it's so important, even if you're a founder who's been through the experience yourself, trying to sense check who else has this experience and how are these experiences differing. But I think also that insight you had around, actually, for the customer or the user or the person who needs the service, as you say, it's not that they're thinking about it necessarily as like distinct tasks or distinct areas. Love that. How did you know to do all of this stuff at the beginning? You're speaking to customers, you're modeling the user journey before you're trying to come up with a solution. And I would say that's not how most of our brains work. Certainly when I have an idea, often it comes to me as a solution, or at least certainly used to do so a lot more, but often I have this idea and it's fully packaged and ready to go to market in my head. And then it's pulling myself back and working. Okay, what am I trying to solve? And is this the right thing at all? Mm-hmm. But how did you know how to do any of that?
So professionally, I'd worked in strategy. So a little bit had come from that. How do you evaluate whether an idea is a good idea? So I was taking those kind of scorings. Is there a market? How big's the market? What are people doing currently? And then I guess I brought some professional experience and a framework in, which was definitely helpful. The startup I was at, the insurance company, it was a pet healthcare startup. And actually at that time, that was my first job out of uni, pretty much, via doing UX design and being an ad agency. And I'd ended up doing kind of the design thinking process without really knowing I was doing it. So I remember at the time mapping out the market, going to the park and talking to lots of dog owners about their pets and whether they have pet insurance. And so I kind of learned the on the ground how to just go out and talk to people, basically. And I just brought that in. And it was interesting because when you're in an incubator, basically, you're trying to potentially find a co-founder. So there's this big drama, and it's like kind of Love Island meets Dragon's Den, and everyone's like trying to get together. And I remember the first couple of weeks doing that. And then I thought, do you know what I want to build. I'm going to focus on developing the business, because I could spend lots of time trying to find a co-founder and end up not working on the business, and I'm here to build the business. So I basically just went off and started doing this research, and I was very clear that I wanted to go through this process to understand, is there this opportunity? And actually, one of the things I look back on was the ideas for features, basically, that we had at that point were pretty much exactly the same as what right now are still on our roadmap. And I almost wish I had more conviction about building earlier, because I think I over-researched in hindsight, because I was a bit, it's a bit scary launching a business and you want to try and de-risk it as much as possible. So I was like, I'm going to research everything so thoroughly that I know there's an opportunity. And I wish at 70% I'd taken the leap and started building rather than waiting till 90%. And I try my best now to learn from that and use my gut a bit more. And I don't think gut's great, but it's also conditioned by lots of external factors. So one thing I didn't say was also launched a meetup group at that point for a divorce group and a bereavement group. And still to this day, at least once a month now, I personally run support groups, peer-to-peer support groups. And over the pandemic, every Sunday morning, I ran an hour-long support group. So I'm so close to our customers and I'm still so close to them. And I honestly, anyone setting up a business, I would recommend setting up some kind of meetup or Facebook group to talk to people about this problem, because it is such a good way of understanding the pain. So I think there was, yeah, in answer to your question, a bit of my previous experience basically, and I brought that in, and then just a bit of kind of hustle. Just like, how can you do this? How can you figure this stuff out? And just trying and trying, and found something that fit.
And so did those people in the meetup group become your first customers?
Yeah. And some of those people have still, we've been going like 2 years almost now, still active with us, and still we've actually got, now we have things called grief mentors, who are basically people that feel maybe more able to cope, or like they want to have a sense of purpose and kind of give back, and they welcome other community members, they talk about their experience and how their grief has changed over time. And some of those people, those early people, are now our grief mentors as well.
That's such a good sign of user adoption. I remember listening to things like Goodreads, and they've ended up with like super librarians on Goodreads who are just so in love with the product, they wanted to start helping other people use it. And you think that's such a good sign. Love that. People often ask me this around customer development, like, how many people should I talk to before I start building? And the idea is you shouldn't stop talking to people. As you say, you're still doing it. So it's just at some point in that process, during that process, you're going to have to make a leap. And the numbers that I think can give you an indication are way lower than people think. If you talk to 10 people who have a very similar profile and shared need, and you're seeing really similar things emerge, then that would give me the confidence to start running tests, as you say, like a meetup group or something else. So it's often, I think people get confused about going speaking to customers. They either think it's going to slow them down and stop them building something because they have to do a huge number before they can move on, or they're desperate to do it, but as you say, it becomes a comfort blanket on its own.
And I think what's interesting about kind of the space that we're in is people were really grateful to get to talk about their grief, because in society we don't discuss death, it's such a taboo. We don't, divorce is a taboo, we don't discuss these difficult topics. And so actually a lot of people thanked me after essentially what was a user interview, and said, I haven't actually sit down, stepped back and spoke and reflected on this as kind of as one big story before. In conversation, you normally talk about an aspect of your bereavement, for example, and I'm probably telling you what you already know, but actually a lot of people, thanks, I've got to reflect on this and talk about it. And it's been really nice, which was really refreshing as well, doing those user interviews.
No, I can 100% imagine that. And again, it's a sign you're onto something really good if people are finding catharsis in talking about it. Whether it's grief is, I guess, fits this almost more, because often you're going through something like therapy or bereavement counseling maybe, and so your talking therapy is often part of that. But even for other businesses, if your customer has a real pain, don't underestimate how much they're going to enjoy having someone to vent about it who cares, because they're experiencing that pain and they want to share it and feel heard. Love that. So we've got to the stage where you've got these meetup groups, and as you said, you maybe wish you'd started building the product a little bit earlier, but you do start building. What did you prioritize first, and how did you test it? How did you build?
So I think this has been probably the biggest challenge as a founder, I would say, is working out how to prioritize. And I made the mistake early on of trying to do everything, and it's been a hard and slightly expensive lesson, but now got to a place where we tried to do everything, and then I basically then prioritized and started with community and information. But initially, the very, very first prototype was 200 people that I found on Facebook groups, and said, do you want to meet some other people who relate and get help with all the practical questions that you might have? And set up, had a type form, people signed up to, we had 200 people, and then set up WhatsApp groups based on who you'd lost. And my like WhatsApp logo for ages was the early Untangle logo, and it was Emily at Untangle. And then the chat groups do weekly prompts. And then on, I basically messaged more directly saying, if you want to ask any questions or find out more, if you're going through probate or you're having any troubles mending, just message me. And that was the first thing. So ran it for 6 weeks. 90% of people of the 200 said that they wanted to stay beyond the first 6 weeks in those groups and with the early service, if you like. And that was the beginning. So, and we've gone through lots of iterations since then. But essentially where we are today is an app where we have the same, these peer support groups based on who you lost, how you lost them, where you live, and their chat groups. And we have video support groups, so the same as essentially what was Meetup. We do some in-person groups, and that's our community, and it's all safeguarded and moderated. And we're starting to work with some charities and organizations and individuals who've had to specialize in cancer loss, or with Helen, who runs an Instagram page called Lockdown Grief, and she lost her dad at the start of the pandemic. So she runs a group on our platform for COVID loss. So it's basically evolved almost as a direct line via a few different platforms and things since then. And then the other thing, that kind of chat helpline that was just me on WhatsApp, is now a chat helpline with a care team in the app that people can talk to and ask questions and get help and advice. And obviously there's other aspects that have developed since then, but really there's quite a straight kind of through line from that initial offering.
And I'm grinning away because it's just, again, there's just so much that you've done very smartly. So many people would think, I need to build an app at the beginning of this. I need to build a messaging app. But you're like, nope, there's already something that has basic functionality. And I think another startup that did this was Olio. So they're a waste food sharing service. So anyone can list something that they have left over that someone else in their local community might want. And again, they just tested it with WhatsApp before they built their service, and you get such rich data because you see how people are using it, you see what questions they're asking, what they need. And as you say, like 6 weeks, I can imagine you had so much to use to create better content, to better tailor which features you built when and how.
And there was, we had a Wix website, and the Wix website, I remember I spent like a week researching basically what to do when someone dies, and created this drop down. So it was week one, register the death, notify the government, and all the way through. And had a friend of a friend whose mum was a lawyer, and she checked it. And I think I asked my own therapist if he could check some of the emotional stuff, and had a family friend who was a financial advisor, and was like, can you check this bit? And so that was, and actually a lot of that content is the skeleton of the content. We have now over 100 articles and videos to help people along that journey. But some of that was the beginnings of the content we now have on the site as well. So yeah, it's just trying to do things leanly. There is another school of thought, which is you understand, you go and you build, and it was funny enough, I was talking about it with the founder friend yesterday. Like, the other school of thought is you test, you learn, and then rather than doing a kind of shoddy prototype, you go and actually build the leanest thing as beautifully as you possibly can. And I don't know, when I look back, I think we definitely have done some great, I think the testing and kind of validating before building, I think did really effectively. I think the building, potentially, this is the honest founder piece, but I think I tried sometimes to be too hacky, actually, and put too many things together. And actually, in the time it spent doing something in a hacky way, researching, doing something in a hacky way, realizing that you've hit a limitation when you want to develop it further, then having to find something else to hack together, I wonder if we could have actually used that time to build something very beautiful. But you just never know, do you? And so it's a tough one. But I think building with more conviction is something that I've realized need to do. Once you realize that actually there are enough customers that want something, and they want to use it, and they're willing to pay for it, just going out and starting to build it and not waiting for too many proof points. So what you were saying earlier, maybe building it in a way that's got more longevity. Always a hard balance though, because there was one point when I can't remember what it was we were building, but we were building something thinking about could this be scalable to 100,000 people? And you're like, it's probably going to take us an extra month and a half to ship this by thinking about that. And we don't have a month and a half. Like, we just need to get this out the door and start getting feedback. And we can worry about that when we get to the 100,000 mark and we've got a bigger team and more resource. There's always that tension, I think, of getting things out the door quickly, but also trying to recognize where everything that you're developing is going to hit its limitation as well.
100%. And I think the smart founders are very aware of that tension. As you say, like, it's uncomfortable. And it's, as you say, you're also going to always have ones where you just get it wrong and you're like, that was a waste of time. Actually, it would have been quicker to pay someone to do it well. That would have been the smarter way to test it. Okay, I'll learn it for next time. But you talked about having enough customers willing to pay. When did you check the paying piece for Untangle?
Yeah, good question. So we've gone through different, I should say right now we are pre-revenue. We've done some early testing with essentially the services that we offer or will offer through partners. So basically there was a couple proof points about monetization. We looked at what people are already doing at this point in time. So people are already buying funerals, using solicitors to administer an estate, often getting financial advice. They're selling houses that they inherit, they're renting them out. And often when people have a big life event, they buy insurance and write their will. And basically, one of the proof points was, okay, people are already spending money here, but they're spending it on services that having to shop around to find. And so if we can make that easier for them, we can capture some of that spending. That was one piece. And then over kind of bits of time, we've tested out therapy. We were driving a lot of therapy through the platform and we were getting 35% of new users converting to booking therapy in our kind of test month. So we know that we can convert this kind of loyal member base into cash. And the other thing was, initially we're going to monetize through partners. So could we get partners to want to work with us? And we've had 100% success rate with partners. So every partner that we've approached that we want to work with, funeral homes, solicitors, therapists, coaches, financial advisors, have wanted to work with us. Do customers want to pay? And were they willing to pay? Yes, they're already buying these services. Yes, well, we've done some early testing. They've bought them through us. And are partners willing to work with us in the interim and the beginnings as we monetize? Yes. And so that's been our testing. I think it has been like not our primary focus. And that's because actually one of the amazing things about Untangle and what we do is we get someone really early in this very sensitive process. We get them to really trust us and stay with us along that whole journey. And because we know that people are already spending money on that journey, the important thing was, can we really get someone to stay and keep coming back and asking questions all the way along? Because that positions us as the people that essentially own the customer. And that's what we've been focused on. And we've achieved that. We have fantastic kind of retention rates over 12 months and 48% we get to views of our latest cohort of members. So a really engaged and sticky community. And that was the kind of entry point to then say, right, now we can commercialize this.
And my assumption is the partners got super excited because you've got this sticky, wonderful community. Was there anything else you think you did really well that kind of got that 100% success rate for partners signing up?
I probably should have a secret answer to this. I think people just wanted to see change. And everyone knows that this is a tough time for people and they want as much help as possible. The other thing is most of the partners deal with one step. Your dad said he had 170 steps. Most partners deal with one step. They deal with one aspect of the journey and they don't really want to have to handle someone who's like emotional and grieving. And your funeral director doesn't really want to get calls about probate and your solicitor doesn't really want to get calls about feeling a bit low. And in fact, they're the only people that are really the points of contact. And so a lot of the partners actually just said, yeah, that's great. Like, we can work with you. And then we can essentially not have to deal with the customers around this life of this, our point in the journey. That was one aspect. And the other is actually a lot of the companies that we're working with are not very digital businesses. They're your high street businesses. And what we're offering is, hey, look, this digital tech business, we can reach these people. We can reach them fairly cheaply. And that means for you guys, like, your marketing costs are essentially less because their marketing cost is commission to us. So both commercially and also just from a kind of, it's cost saving to them. It means they get these great leads, but also they're just not having to deal with grieving people outside of the remit of the services they offer. And so that, I think those things helped us a lot. And yeah, it's just having really open conversations as well. And we've tried to be as like honest and approachable as a brand as possible.
Is the model one where you're scaling by going and finding these local services? How do you scale and grow it on both sides, I guess, on the partner side and on the grieving side?
So in terms of reaching people that need us, we do that at the moment mainly through social media, actually, and then also working with hospices. And we've started being socially prescribed by the NHS as well. So we've got two regions socially prescribing us. So basically going to where people are and they're grieving, kind of offering support. We also have really strong word of mouth referral because there's so little support. When people do find it and they find something great, they recommend it. So that's lovely. And then in terms of the partners, really the strategy is ultimately there's a lot of services that don't exist along the journey. And there's a lot of services that probably could be done better or at a slightly better price. And our partners are fantastic. And some of the services, we're never going to offer funerals ourselves. I can say that almost with confidence now. Like, it's just not an industry that I want to go into. So we'll always work with partners, but there are some services that we probably could at some point offer ourselves. And a lot of what we're doing is underpinned by a lot of technology and data. So it's basically, as people interact with our information and our advice and our community, we're building up quite a big data set. And from that, we can start to understand what people need, when they need it, how they need it, and also really using our platform, start to triage people as well. So there's a lot of automation that can happen as well that will mean that people get the right services, and we can offer some of those in-house, either digitally and a kind of we see a hybrid model where, you know, some of the things can be delivered through chat and be automated. And then when you really need to speak to an expert, you've got someone. And most people don't necessarily need to get a solicitor to administer their whole estate, for example, but they might just want to have a 20-minute chat with a solicitor to ask a couple of questions. And that's where the beauty of what we do can, essentially, we can support people at all different kind of price points for all different needs. So yeah.
Love it. So lots of potential revenue streams, which is a lovely transition for me, because we know who loves lots of potential revenue streams is investors. So what are your thoughts around fundraising, routes to capital? What are you thinking about? What have you done so far?
Yes. So the lovely investors and fundraising. So the very first thing we did as Zinc was ending, Zinc have actually changed their model now, and they give a 75K investment at the start of the business. But when I was on Zinc, that wasn't the case. And so there was a point where I was like, in 2 months, I'm not going to be able to pay my rent. And I'm starting to think about, can I get some kind of a cafe job to subsidize this and work part time? And fortuitously applied for an Innovate UK grant and basically got it. And it was genuinely like a week. There was like a week to go. And it was one of those. And I think that's the story of being this a startup. Like, it's always close to the end in a way. You're always having this existential, are we going to grow? Can we make this happen? Yeah, the money came in, and it was a fast grant, which meant that it came in a lump sum, like straight away. And I remember trying to open a bank account in time to apply for the grant and harassing Starling on Twitter, basically saying, we need this open by tomorrow, please. So that was the beginning. And then raised an angel round from fantastic investors that have been so helpful. Like, we've got the former managing director of Co-op Funerals, got people from some investors that are really kind of experienced and have been kind of investors, but also almost mentors and advisors as well. That's been fantastic. And yeah, I'm now starting to look at what does the next round of funding look like? What's the shape? Obviously, looking at the market at the moment, there's been lots of conversations about the VC market at this point. But yeah, we're in a really interesting position as a business now, because we're basically growing in terms of our user numbers. We've just surpassed 12,500 members. We're growing like 28% a month. And we've got everything. We've got these commercial partnerships in place now. So we're ready to start monetizing. And so actually, it's quite exciting, because investors that come in now are coming into a business that's about to start really generating a lot of revenue. And so, yeah, I'm just working out what the shape of the next round looks like at the moment.
Interesting. And a lot of founders keep telling me at the moment their like backup plan is crowdfunding, which I keep being scared by when you tell me crowdfunding is the backup plan because you need 40% committed before you crowdfund and you need a community. But actually, potentially Untangled is a really good candidate because you have that strong community who is super engaged. Mm. Really looking forward to watching it play out. I want to move on though. Obviously, I am very excited for your incredible stats, but I also want to dig into the kind of hard and messy stuff. So it's great to hear the business is going really well now, but have there been really hard moments when you thought it was all going to fall apart? You said already you had one where you thought you were going to run out of cash. Have there been others that have just been really brutal as a founder that maybe other founders can take a bit of faith from, that they're not the only ones going through it?
Yeah. Am I allowed to swear on this show?
Yeah.
I was about to say it's fucking hard. That is like, it's, you know what? It's just being resilient, part of the job. And it's funny, I'm one of those people that I try and rationalize everything. So I look at it, I'm like, you know what? The worst thing that happens is that the business just doesn't exist anymore. That's the worst thing. And it'll be fine. And in some ways, it's quite fortunate because in the world of startup, if you launch a business and it doesn't succeed, I think people still generally are like, well done, you tried something. Mm. Whereas in other sectors, and my boyfriend's a filmmaker, your first film flops, you're not getting any more funding. So I use all these stories to make myself feel better about it. But ultimately, I really believe in the need for this. I see this huge commercial opportunity, and I'm like, I speak to our members and I'm like, obviously this has to succeed and obviously it's going to grow. And so having that means it's also terrifying at times when things don't go to plan, because I'm working against myself in a way. I've got this kind of belief and this drive, and then also the kind of, oh no, this might not happen. So some moments, there's been so many moments. So we had that moment when we were about to run out of money. And then again, the same, when I closed that angel round, it was literally 2 days before Christmas. Our kind of lead investor essentially came in and called me. And I remember pacing around. I was in a flat share. I lived with six people, like my bedroom at the time. And him basically calling and saying, yeah, I'm going to put in 120K. And it was like, it was a kind of unlock moment, because if you don't get that and you don't raise the whole round and all of those things. And it was really strange, because I remember coming downstairs into the kitchen to my flatmates, who I found through a house share I wasn't particularly close to, and wanting to be like, guys, I've just closed this money. And like, this massive moment, in this big moment in my life, and hopefully one of many more to come. But And then, oh, that's nice, that's cool. Like, how was your day, kind of thing. And yeah, one of the other things, like the end of last year, we built a community offering in-house using basically WordPress and a bunch of plugins, which we thought would be really quick and we'd get it live, and basically realized that it wasn't quite delivering what we needed. And that was like 3 months and a lot of developer money just down the drain. And then you kind of have to go out to investors and be like, yeah, we're replatforming. And it was a really scary decision. And the decision was also, I'd been thinking about it. I was like, we're not going to get to where we need to go in terms of like the functionality that we need in the timeframe we need at the quality we need if we carry on down this route. And obviously you kick yourself and think, how much of this could I have realized earlier? Are there things that we did do very thorough research, but ultimately you come down to building and sometimes these off the shelf things don't behave as you expect. And I remember approaching the team, and bear in mind, they'd all designed this and been working on it and like working with the developers and stuff, and having to say, I actually think we might have to scrap the last 3 months. And everyone was very, if we just give it one more month, we'll probably be there. And it was really difficult. I had to slowly bring the team round to seeing that this was the best option. And that was really tough, because you're taking something that everyone's invested a lot of time and energy into. And 3 months in the big scheme of things isn't that much. When you're working very hard, which everyone does, it feels like a lot. So that was difficult. There's just been so many, like our Instagram got hacked 3 weeks or 4 weeks ago. We have almost 40,000 followers, and it's one of our main customer acquisition channels. And the account just got taken down, and I was on holiday, and it was like, and I remember just waking up and being, spending half the day just in the room, like, who do I know that works at Meta? And has anyone, have they got any connections there? And what is the customer helpline? And basically having to go through this process. And thankfully, someone I know worked there and was amazing and essentially helped us. We still don't know what happened, but we've got two-factor authentication. We've changed everything, all our passwords and our personal passwords. But it's just stuff like that where, and I've learned now to just take it in my stride and be like, when things feel like they're going okay, something will go wrong. And that's just part of it. And yeah, I try to look at it as it's just kind of part of the fun. Like it's part of the challenges. So yeah, that was part of my holiday.
I love also podcasts. And there are a few other episodes where kind of founders share horror stories. And I think I was listening to Buffer had one where Buffer is a platform that manages lots of people's social media and they got hacked. So like they suddenly everyone who was a Buffer user was getting just, it was like everywhere. It was on Facebook, it was on Twitter. All their messages were just spam. So many users and the founders having a nice brunch for once on a Saturday. It's only ever when you're relaxing. It's never when you're in the office ready to fix the problem. But yeah,
well, that's terrible. Yeah, that must have been a nightmare. Oh, Figma went down, didn't it, the other day, which was like, so many people rely on. And but there's always a risk, and it's always, yeah, it's always going to happen at the worst time, isn't it?
But I think it is nice in those moments. It's not going to make them not stressful, and it's not going to reduce your urgency to fix it, but it is nice to know like there are other big brands that have been through something similar and survived. It's not, I'm a terrible catastrophizer. Everything can be the end of the world if I'm not careful. And so, as you say, being able to remind yourself, okay, what is actually the worst outcome here? Like we can fix this, we will re-secure it, we will explain to our users, it will be okay. But in the moment, maybe knowing that someone else has been through it and you're not alone helps. Thank you so much for sharing those. And really good to hear feels like the wrong thing to say, because I don't want any founder to go through hard moments, but helpful to hear to feel maybe less alone. So I want to end not on the negative though. So what have been some of the most exciting moments for you, or the most, maybe most meaningful given what you do?
It's probably a cliche, but genuinely every day when I wake up, I'm like, I feel so lucky to be doing this job. I absolutely believe in it. And we see our members, we get thank you messages pretty much every day. Like we have a Slack channel where we share customer feedback. And most of the time it's just screenshots of people saying, thank you so much. We're so glad I found you and it's been so helpful. And so that is lovely. And I know, because I do facilitate some of our peer support groups, I've got to know some of our members over the last year, year and a half, those grief mentors that have been with us from day one. So that stuff makes me feel great. And then it's the same, it's talking to potential partners, people that have been in the industry for 20 years that say, yeah, I'd absolutely love to work with you, love what you're doing and can see the opportunity. And it's all of those moments. We had a really lovely, one of the things I didn't mention is we have a safeguarding lead and a team of volunteers who most of them have had a bereavement themselves, and they basically moderate the community. And we went for an axe throwing team social about a month and a half ago. And I don't recruit or train the moderators, so most of them I don't really know. And we had this social and it was kind of the team and all the moderators and just all these brilliant, amazing people that really care and do a fantastic job to keep the community safe, and meeting everyone and having this moment of, yeah, like we're all doing something together that is genuinely changing people's lives at these hard moments. And I think that was like, I'm quite a people person. That's what kind of the work we're doing is ultimately to, yes, it's, we're building a big commercial business, but it's also to help people, which is beautiful because it does both. And I think then also seeing the people behind the scenes who are enabling that was just a really lovely, we were all like having a drink after axe throwing, and it was just this lovely moment. I thought, do you know what? This is really special. Yeah, there's been a lot of highs. It's funny, the highs don't come very often because I'm always looking for like where the problems are, where we can be, like my nature is like, where can we be doing better? What can we be doing more of? So I'm not very good at stepping back and saying, wow, like what an achievement. But when we hit 10,000 member milestone, and I think just, yeah, being out at the pub, having a drink and looking around to be like, yeah, you know what? We're doing something cool here. That was probably my most recent high.
Love that. Final question. What is the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
I was trying to think about this beforehand, and I was really struggling. Probably trust your gut. hope for the best, plan for the worst.
No.
Yeah. I think different pieces of advice resonate at different times, but yeah, trusting your gut is probably a good one. And I can't remember who told me that, unfortunately.
This has been so interesting. Love the business. I could not think it's more needed, and it's just so exciting to see. And yeah, just love seeing how you're growing it. Can't wait to watch what you do with it.
Thanks. Yeah, it's really lovely talking, and sometimes it's so nice just to sit back and reflect. So thanks for creating this opportunity as well. It was really lovely to chat.
Oh, maybe we'll do a follow-up interview in a few years when you've scaled and you're massive. Can't wait.
Yep, me too.
Thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please do take a moment to rate and share. It really does make a huge difference to our growth. And for more founder oh shit moments, success stories, and the insights behind them both, do subscribe today.